Most everyone by now has a handle on the intoxicating side of the cannabis story. So let's turn to the non-intoxicating side of the story. We'll call it the hemp side of cannabis and ask, can we build a viable industry with hemp?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Folks, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1227th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Guaymas who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, when we the people began planting seeds in the ground some 10,000 years ago, give or take, one of those seeds was likely that of the cannabis plant. The reason for our very long and fruitful relationship with cannabis was, and is, the plant's utility. Not only did its chemicals lift our spirits, but its fibers allowed us to harness the wind and allowed us to sail around the world. And so wherever we went, cannabis went as well. But then, the best part of a century ago, we decided that the cannabis plant was no longer useful, and so established laws that prohibited its existence. That prohibition, however, came with unintended consequences. Before prohibition, one could purchase all the cannabis one wanted for pennies per pound. After decades of prohibition, the price of cannabis was thousands of dollars per pound. When something that can be grown for pennies per pound can be sold for thousands of dollars per pound, you end up with an intoxicating side of the cannabis story. But somewhere along the line, we began changing our mind about prohibition. One of the things that helped change our mind was that we realized that we were missing out on all the other gifts of cannabis. And when we began to call it medicine, the walls of prohibition began to tumble down. It is now legal to grow cannabis in the United States, provided one does not grow it for intoxicating properties. That farmers are planting cannabis again leads us to ask, can we build a viable industry with hemp? Here to help us find an answer, we have Doug Fine, who is a farmer and an author of Hemp Farmer, Adventures and Misadventures in the Cannabis Trade. Doug, welcome to the Food Chain.
It's terrific to be here with you, Michael.
And with me with a brand new book, right?
I, as a matter of fact, yes. And the word American in front of Hemp Farmer is an interesting title, because the phenomenon we're describing, humanity's reestablishment of its very long, millennia-long relationship with the cannabis plant, after what was historically a very short blip, this prohibition you referenced is 77 years. This is a worldwide phenomenon. At one event, I was asked to speak before the United Nations on cannabis policy, and a fellow who had flown in on his own dime was a Moroccan cannabis farmer from the Reef region. And so people are openly reestablishing our relationship with the cannabis plant worldwide. And for me, frankly, it's a fundamental part of a lot of things, family's health, maintenance and all that, but also what you might talk about as patriotism. Without rambling too long, I was honored, and this is mentioned in the book, I was able to harvest hemp alongside Dean Norton, the terrific horticulture manager, director at George Washington's Mount Vernon, the first crop since George Washington's crop, the first hemp crop. Hand harvested it in alongside some friends and colleagues in colonial clothing with a sickle that was, I can attest, from the blood that flowed, very, very sharp.
You know what? That must have been a fun experience. And of course, one of my favorite places back there is Monticello. And, of course, Thomas Jefferson was also a cannabis farmer, as were most of the farmers back then. And it's amazing how we lost track of that during our brief 75, 77-year period of prohibition. But, boy, we sure did. Now, I have a two-part question for you. The first part, Doug Fine, is which came first for you, the cannabis or the goats?
An excellent question, appropriate for this show. as a fundamental part of my adult lifestyle, I would say the goat came first. That's in terms of being a producer myself. Goats came first. A long time ago, I decided to try to minimize petroleum, but you know, we're only able to have this conversation through some of the wonderful parts of the digital age, right? So keep digital age comforts, but reduce petroleum, see if that was possible, see what wasn't possible and what the possibilities were. Wrote a book about it called Farewell My Subaru, Live in the Middle of Nowhere in New Mexico, and living in bliss. I mean, my alarm clock this morning was hummingbird wings outside my window. So thank you, hummingbirds, for getting me to this interview on time. So all good there. Then hemp gets legalized. In between, I wrote a book about sustainable and regenerative community-building psychoactive cannabis farmers in the famous Emerald Triangle of California. That book was called Too High to Fail. From them, I learned, as you mentioned in your introduction, Michael, about how underutilized the other parts of the hemp plant are. And connecting the dots is a long answer to which came first, goats or hemp. When hemp became legal in the U.S., I started cultivating in the states where it was legal and researching it for what became this new book, American Hemp Farmer. And it only became legal here in my home state of New Mexico last year. So I'm prepping the soil now with my family for second season of providing our own superfood here, which we'd be doing anyway, regardless of the outside world situation. The goats love hemp. Hemp protein is a so-called byproduct of hemp seed oil pressing, so your whole family, human and non-human, gets to eat. And connecting the dots, the fiber from that hemp, it requires a large volume to be viable when it comes to feeding the world economic pipeline. But connecting the dots to my original mission in Farewell My Subaru and lifestyle-wise of living as regenerative possible, the things that seemed impossible to be regenerative are now showing that hemp and other biomaterials are viable options for those applications. Things like the batteries that store the power from solar panels and the, for now, rare earth minerals and not very sustainable stuff that's in the devices that are allowing me to speak with you today. Those can actually all be made from regenerative biomaterials, something that I talk a little bit about in the book. And I like to say hemp-based supercapacitors, which have been shown to outproduce less sustainable.
Well, before we head off in that direction, let me finish the second part of my two-part question. You say goats came before cannabis. Now I would like to ask, how long would it take your goats to eat their way through your cannabis patch?
I can give a somewhat educated answer about that, a somewhat formal quantitative answer on that, because it's an ongoing experiment.
Uh-huh.
One of the fun things about having goats is they will try to get where you don't want them to go, because like our relationship with the cannabis plant, we have co-evolved with goats. We've been interacting with them as long as we have with dogs. And so we do have that sixth sense, greater understanding. Your goats love you as much as your dogs do, but they just don't care about listening to you all the time. And they listen to you if it's mutually beneficial. And if you don't want them to do something, they have evolved to think it's probably because it's tasty. So not just temp, but they try to get into any place on the ranch that I don't want them to. But I did the math on hemp production. And here in New Mexico, we grow a very small amount. I grow larger quantities in other states. But if I were to expand to between 5 and 10 acres of food production for hemp. Many people now are growing for the flower apps, the CBD, et cetera, CBG, and it's all wonderful stuff. But the food application, which comes from growing males and females and getting seeds, between 5 and 10 acres, probably could feed my human and non-human family.
There you go. Wow. Well, let's, before we get to food, too, I'd like to get back to the cannabis plant itself and ask you, what do you mean by hemp? Where did the word hemp come from? Is that something that we've used to describe one of the uses of cannabis over the course of our history? Or is it a word like marijuana that gives meaning, one kind of meaning, to the word hemp?
I'm so glad that you asked that question, because it gets to one of the fundamental issues in hemp right now as it launches back into the above-ground economy in a big way. Fastest agricultural-based industry ever to cross $1 billion in annual sales, and just getting going now. We're still in our infancy. The feds barely have an idea of their regulations, which we can talk about if desired, but there's that stuff is just in draft form and unfolding. But and yet the industry's on. It's going, right? So these definitions are a fundamental fulcrum in the digital age's re-embracing of one of humanity's longest utilized crops. So to answer your question as concisely as possible, the idea of cannabis of any kind, call it hemp, call it cannabis, call it ganja, call it whatever you like, the idea of it being divided into categories based on this chemical called THC, this compound that's one of 110 cannabinoids in the plant, is a very, very new thing. It was only 19, when the Israeli researcher, Mshelem, isolated THC. It was 62 or 67. So the war on drugs was 30, 40 years on before anybody even knew that there was such a thing as THC. Then the delineation that the hemp industry is working with, and I would say suffering through right now, it's the number one issue. The worst thing about the hemp industry right now is this 0.3% THC definition of hemp that delineates it from every other kind of cannabis. It was admitted by the people, the Canadian researchers who suggested it in the 1976 paper to be an arbitrary level. The good news is everybody knows this. A cross-partisan issue on the federal level, major push on right now to change the definition to 1% of THC by dry weight, which is a good start. Just to show you how it's not even the end game, the National Farmers Union is asking for 3%. My and many other independent farmer entrepreneurs would like to see THC irrelevance at the federal level. The last people that we should be bugging about one compound in their plant are the farmers, because the only time it should ever matter is if a product is going to the public. And the reason for that is everything from the seed to the fiber to the flower to components of the flower to components of the roots to the leaves for tea, anything, even so, I could go on. Everything is potentially being used, and literally only one tiny thing, THC, has a potentially psychoactive effect. So only if this THC part in a product is going to market should a state, not the feds, state decide at what level it should be psychoactive. And that's a viable endgame, and I hope it's not too wonky, but that's the deal. Cannabis is one plant with a ton of different uses.
There you go. And so we give some of those different uses different kinds of names. I think that's where the word marijuana came from, was to denote the intoxicating varieties of cannabis, and hemp kind of evolved to address the other uses of cannabis, of which there are many. And that's what we're going to pick up when we come back. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today, we're chewing on the issue of cannabis with respect to the non-intoxicating properties of the plant that has been a partner of ours for many thousands of years, and it looks like we're bringing it back and trying to make it into a viable industry again as it once was. With us today, we have Doug Fine, who is a farmer and author of Hemp Farmer, Adventures, Misadventures in the Cannabis Trade. Can't wait to hear about the adventures and misadventures, because I'll bet there's some very good stories in that. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, Michael Olson here with Doug Fine, farmer and author of The American Hemp Farmer, as opposed to any other farmers. But yeah, they are. They're hemp farmers all over the world now, aren't there?
There absolutely are. I've learned a lot from European farmers, Asian farmers, and African farmers.
And we're not Canadian farmers still growing hemp, even when it was highly illegal and immoral here in the United States?
The Canadian hemp industry opened in 96, and some places like France and China and parts of Japan never stopped their traditional cultivation.
There you go. So we've been doing this for a long time. You mentioned that cannabis is kind of like a camp follower. I love that description. What did you mean by it?
Before sedentary agriculture, when most humans were what today we kind of would call them semi-nomadic or nomadic, often, and this is something I learned from in my region in New Mexico from speaking to a friend of an Apache background, that, you know, he said, people said we were nomadic, but it was really two seasons. It was seasonal, you know, it was like people have their summer house and their winter house. And so you brought seeds and planted stuff. We still recognize there are awesome plants, but if you're mobile, you can't fit that many kinds of seeds into a pouch, and you choose the ones that are most broadly useful to you. And cannabis has across the globe, especially what we shorthand as old world, been nearly everywhere. And so this is a plant that gives us so much. We talked a little bit earlier about THC and how it's just one part of a plant that has so many uses. And also important to mention, from an agronomic and agricultural standpoint, having THC in the plant makes for a more robust plant in many of the applications for which no THC will show up. For instance, fiber applications. China at the moment is the world leader in acres and by far in hemp acres overall, but by far the hemp fiber production leader. If you have stuff that's made from clothing, rather, that's made from hemp, it's almost certainly coming from China or Romania or possibly Nepal. And so those farmers are not undergoing multiple THC tests at labs every year. They're growing varieties that grow the best fiber. It wouldn't matter if the THC is 0.3 or 30% dispensary level in the flowers. The market is the fiber, although I should say China's rapidly discovering the cannabinoid gold rush in the flower. But point being, THC irrelevance is essential for the strength of the industry far beyond any flower applications, but into seed and fiber applications.
But let's go to the flower and talk about the CBD gold rush that we've just been going through here recently. My goodness, it seems like everybody in America was selling CBD oil.
Yeah, so the flower part of the plant. Hemp provides flower, seed, and fiber, in short. I'll quickly refer to two other things. There's roots / phytoremediation. The roots have traditional uses. If you look at medieval British books, so the cannabis tinctures and brews are often about the root. But the root is also amazing at phytoremediation, soil building, soil cleanup on the world's very stressed soils. So that's something to keep in mind. And then leaves are used with different properties than flowers. So leaving those leaves and roots out and only talking about the big three of seed, fiber, and flower, the gold rush resides in the flower at the moment. And that's also what the main product was for people during Prohibition. People were looking for, on a female flower generally, these trichomes, these goopy mushroom-looking crystals grow, and they're full of 110 known compounds, known cannabinoids. They work in an entourage effect. They work together based on ratios similar to omega ratios in our diet. And they interact also with other compounds in the plant known as terpenes and bioflavonoids that folks may be familiar with from other plants like peppers and stuff. But the cannabinoids in them, the most famous ones are THC, which is why there was Woodstock, CBD, which because of its extreme effectiveness in air, people are finding relief in, one has to be careful about claims, people are finding good results in pain relief, and then certain types of cytotoxicity, meaning cancerous tumor reversal, and certain types of epilepsy, particularly very special types of childhood epilepsy relief compared to what we call mainstream medical applications. When all else fails, CBD is saving lives in certain types of childhood epilepsy. So CBD became this big, great thing. And it is a great thing. And I eat cannabinoids every day in the morning in a shake, coffee, yogurt, something along those lines. However, for me, I'm not interested in one particular chemical. In other words, I'm not interested in turning my plant diet into a pharmaceutical diet. And this is not to criticize anybody else's modes. This is just kind of one way of thinking. Right now, the next big craze is CBG, which has uplifting effects. CBN is known to help folks with sleep stuff. And both of those, CBG and CBN, have some documented peer-reviewed results on other types of cancer stuff and all that kind of promising results there. But the plant has evolved in ratios of all these cannabinoids, terpenes, bioflavonoids, and then I like to know that I'm growing it in soil or know my farmer, and I'm looking for a ratio of cannabinoids. I'm not looking for a certain number of milligrams of CBD in a tincture. What I'm looking for is a storyline of a family farm that grows organically, that really nurtured this cultivar. There's a backstory to it. And they really appreciate the pinene terpene, which gives it a certain tangy smell. But they also feel like this obscure CBC cannabinoid that is in equal ratios with its.
So it's a little bit like wine and how the wine grape picks up the essence of the terroir, and that's what you go with.
I wish that I could just like send this interview out to everyone, because that is yet another of the core key points in the book Terroir. And so the chapter name in American Hemp Farmer that deals with this is called Green Chili Hemp. And the reason for that is we have our famous green chili kind of brand in New Mexico, the way to Hawaii has a hula hoop, you know, macadamia nut brand, right? And so there's already green chili hemp here. My friend Lou Siebinger puts out this great product that infuses long-used medicinal green chili in with his hemp products. So my argument is that as independent farmer entrepreneurs, somebody else is going to do the chemical extraction of a CBD isolate and stick it in a chain drugstore. That's not us. What we're doing is saying, get green chili hemp. It's different because of where it's grown and the love that we give into it. Every farmer entrepreneur region can have their regional terroir that they infuse, like Parmesan and champagne.
So you're talking about a different kind of industry than the huge commodity industries, of which Bayer and Monsanto and all of those characters, you know, are practicing. When you're talking about the hemp industry or the cannabis industry, you're talking, you seem to be talking about a local industry made up of people in places. Am I wrong?
No, the fundamental tagline of the book is this time the farmers are in charge. Right at the beginning, as I was researching American Hemp Farmer, I was asked by my friends who were starting a hemp expo in the South, the American South, which is now getting into its third year Southern Hemp Expo. For the first one, they said, Doug, who would be like a good co-keynote with you who's like Southern and on brand with this messaging? And I said, well, Wendell Berry, great Kentucky farm philosopher. So I wrote to him on hemp paper, of course, at P.O. Box 1 in his town in Kentucky, and he immediately got back to me, and I saved the voicemail. And the message was, it's wonderful about hemp, but if farmers are just going to fall into that wholesale trap, I'm paraphrasing here, they're just going to be the same serfs that they've been in every other crop. Like, you have to control your industry as the farmers. And so I really try to push this model of farmer entrepreneurialism, regional mindset. And it's hard because farmers used to think, you know, maybe you're getting screwed by the middleman and maybe the pesticides weren't so healthy, but at least you were done when you dropped it off at the silo and you got a check for whatever it was and you mend harness for a few months. Now you've got to get out there and bottle it and market it and process it and sell it and explain why it's superior to what people can get cheaper in the chain drugstore. So it's not an easy haul, but I think we're at the right moment in our economic development and in our societal sort of evolving for this to be the viable leading brand, you might say. Hemp is associated with small, regional, like you say, wine shop type, top shelf type terroir products.
Yeah. Well, I would suspect it would be very difficult to do if you're way out in the countryside of New Mexico and do not have a market close at hand that you can work. Then you have to do it other ways. And that would be part of what you have to go through. With respect to setting up a farm now, whether you're doing it for medicine or fiber or food, take us back and tell us about food, the food application of cannabis. How does that work?
Many folks will already know that hemp is one of our more nutritious foods. You know, there's a lot of nutritious foods out there, and hemp is just one awesome one and that I eat a lot of every day. And the seed is generally where the nutritive superfood lies. It has an omega balance between omega 9, 6, and 3. It is high in minerals like magnesium that are important. One of the more interesting details that I report about in the book, one is Hemp is a rare source of GLA, a protein building block, gamma linoleic acid, which is associated with anti-inflammatory properties, and inflammation of various body systems is a major part of our diet crisis right now. And speaking of diet crisis, long story short here, but I was honored to be asked to be an affiliated researcher with some seed development research out of the University of Hawaii. And let me tell you, Michael, tough gig. Sorry, I'm going to work. See you guys all soon. I'll be back in a week. I'm going to Hawaii to grow cannabis. And that was a really fun several-year project that I helped with. And the lead professor in that project, the reason why he was spending his time, he's a chemist, the reason he was spending time investing in and trying to get project funding for hemp projects of any kind is because his preliminary research showed that a hemp diet inhibits the growth of lipid cells. We all have the same amount of lipid cells, but when we get fat, they expand, right? Basically, hemp potentially is an obesity fighter, hemp as part of your diet, which is a good thing in my case. Mm-hmm. And it probably explains why I'm not a lot larger. So long story short, it's a astounding superfood and an essential part of, as you mentioned, founding fathers, colonial era farms.
Well, let me ask you this. How do you incorporate hemp seeds into your diet and your family's diet? What do you do?
Sure. And by the way, as I mentioned earlier, for folks, if you truly pack one full acre, let's say even say you can, if you're lucky enough to have that kind of space, 3 acres of dioecious hemp, meaning male and female hemp that provide seeds, that will feed your probably your family and your livestock for a year based on my family's copious diet. How I like to eat it, there's a number of ways that I eat it almost every day. You could eat the whole seeds themselves. Right now, as you mentioned, due to the warpness of the prohibition economy, hemp seeds are so valuable when they're viable, but whole hemp seeds are delicious. Many people like to dehull them, and then you result with these hemp hearts. And pressing the seed results in an incredible oil, and the offshoot, the so-called byproduct of hemp seed oil pressing is this super protein-rich, thick, sometimes called meal, sometimes called cake. So you have hemp seed oil, protein meal, whole seed, and hemp hearts. And I'll eat all of those. The oil is more of a salad oil, something that I'll add to yogurt and shakes or coffee. It's not a cooking oil, and it's nutty. Hemp is actually a nut, so it has a very nutty flavor. And hemp seeds you can put on just about anything, salads, main courses, soup, garnishing soups. I also add several tablespoons to a shake. It goes great in yogurt. I like the cacao hemp heart mix in yogurt, and it's also extremely nutritious, pure organic cacao nibs, in other words.
So you can do pretty much whatever you want with it, except cook.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you wouldn't want to heat it. It's a new taste profile. You know, when you speak to real pros in the industry, it sounds to people like us like, oh, it's going to take over. But, you know, you can actually use that protein meal, too, as well in cooking and baking. And it goes great in pancakes. So there is a chance for it to be a staple, and it needs to be if we're going to rebuild soil, because growing outdoors on large acreage is how we sequester carbon with hemp.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting observation, because it's pretty much exactly the opposite of the way the legal cannabis industry is evolving in places like here in California, where the cannabis is locked in a building that under lights or a greenhouse. It's as far away from nature as a prison when it gets right down to it. So you're talking about a whole different direction of things, of course. So it's possible to do medicine. It's possible to do food. It's possible to do fiber. And you've been working with pretty much all of them. In your experiences in putting together the American Hemp Farmer, which one is most exciting?
Long term, I think that the core, what you might call existing traditional hemp applications, are the most important, namely hemp becoming a staple diet and helping improve dietary health, which is a crisis worldwide, while fighting climate change through regenerative cultivation techniques. that one plus the fiber leading the way to a wider, not just hemp, wider biomaterials resurgence in our industrial pipelines are the two core ones. And so I say those first because these last two that I always love to mention as I shorthand as, hey, some of the coolest new hemp applications of the last 8,000 years, they are. But it really only matters if we're embedding it's great that there's tech stuff I'm about to talk about, but it only means something if we're delivering them in solar powered planes and electric cars and people are living.
We got to hold that thought, Doug. We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to hear about some of your adventures and misadventures, that one would find in the American Hemp Farmer by Doug Fine. I'll bet there must have been some incredible adventures in your research and development of the story. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Doug Fine, who is the author of American Hemp Farmer, Adventures and Misadventures in the Cannabis Trade. And I want to hear about the misadventures right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain, and we are with Doug Fine, who is in New Mexico, where he has a what is the name of your ranch, Doug?
The Funky Butte Ranch.
The Funky Butte Ranch?
Yes.
The Funky Butte Ranch. Wow. And it's in the Pine Hills of southwest New Mexico. And so you have, tell us about your farm. Tell us about how you set up your hemp farm and what it looks like.
Thank you, Michael. I'm enjoying the conversation. So we have 42 acres here and at equilibrium, four to six goats and, you know, assorted livestock and all that good stuff. Hemp only became legalized here in New Mexico last year, so we're starting small. We're hand planting, hand harvesting, drip irrigation, soil prep's going on right now, under an acre we do here at home, although I grow larger acreage with friends in multiple other states. And, very close, planting, range, because I'm not just growing for flower, I'm growing for everything. Tri-crop, as they sometimes say, flower, seed, and fiber. And half inch depth, but right now we're brewing our mycelium inoculant, gathering fungus from the hills and making that into a compost tea, adding our organic goat poop and alfalfa to the soil. Trace minerals from sea, from ocean is the only other additive that we put on our soil, and hemp seems to like it here in New Mexico. It almost seems like it remembers it from before Prohibition. And if I could very quickly, Michael, just tie in a loose end and say that the next generation apps I didn't mention earlier, one was hemp-based plastic, where we actually used fiber from U.S.-grown hemp to 3D print, appropriately enough, a goat, and I'm looking at it here in my office windowsill now, and this is goodbye plastic garbage patch, Pacific garbage patch, because we can build compostable plastic from biomaterial.
Grow our own plastic. Does it biodegrade?
You can do, so the science of plastics is such that you can create it in whatever forms you want. Very rapidly compostable, for instance, for compostable lunch trays and servingware, or longer lasting for space shuttle rocket parts.
And again, we go back to the utility of this cannabis plant, which is truly amazing. But can we make an industry out of it, Doug?
The gap between good ideas and market implementation is, you know, it's a graduate thesis. One thing hemp has going for it, and this has been something that was published in a paper out of Purdue, is that it's the passion of its early players, the people that are in it. Let's put it this way. It's clear as day when somebody is in it from a very, what you might call 20th century hedge fundy markety outlook, because they speak about it in their differently. Their timelines are different. Most of the people who are in it because they believe in it. And
it's kind of like a holy war almost. Do you ever think of yourself as a holy warrior for cannabis?
more along the lines of a baseball player, where as humanity we're in ninth inning, two outs, and we have to rally now to mitigate climate change, or all of our kids and grandkids don't have a place to live.
Well, that's a pretty serious mission. So going back to your farm, do you have how much acreage are you going to put in the cannabis?
And even though I believe it's all one plant, I'll specify for our friends who are listening in law enforcement that I am a permitted hemp farmer in New Mexico, and that's what I grow. Okay. Soon we will make it the law that I shouldn't have to say that. It shouldn't matter what the THC is from what I grow on my own farm. But so the very small crop here in New Mexico, it's really seed development. I'm working because of the temporary insanity of 0.3% THC limits, my crop, generally this cultivar I'm working on has grown in many states, and like so many crops, it really does depend on where you are, but it's generally pretty darn close. It's tested at 0.25 here in New Mexico last year, and that's just ridiculous. Like, these are micro levels that shouldn't matter, up to 3%.
So that seems to be a big issue, though, for not only you, but for other hemp growers, is the THC level. How does the DEA factor into hemp farming? I mean, do they come to your farm and with their meters and their check things out and see what your THC level is? Is that how it works?
No, the feds don't, because they're state-administered programs. And again, briefly, I joke about, you know, hello to folks listening in law enforcement. I just do like to say before I leap into policy that I do appreciate the work that law enforcement does, and most law enforcement people are very honest and hardworking and do their best for public safety. And also, most of the people that are in federal law enforcement are not the deciders setting the policy. They're just doing what their bosses tell them, which is, you know, whatever. But long story short, the federal war on cannabis is very nearly over, but it's not 100% over until the federal law legalizes all cannabis, which, you know, is now in the national debate. There are presidential candidates saying at debates, it's what I'm doing on day one of my, like, people that recognize it's really important. This is not like, oh, it's just a fun, goofy thing that's legalized, you know, wacky tobacco.
Well, just back up just a little bit, because I understand in the most recent farm bill, they did make hemp farming legal, and then put it under state guidelines. Now, is it a federal law then that you can't have greater than 3%? Is that where the sticking point is for you?
Yes, that is exactly it. Number one thing that has to happen is the federal definition of hemp needs to change from 0.3%, because hemp was, you're absolutely right, 2018 Farm Bill, the first codified full commercial end to federal cannabis prohibition was that cannabis with 0.3% or less THC was removed from the Controlled Substances Act. It's no longer under the purview of the Justice Department. It's a crop like it always has been under USDA. The problem is the first regulations that USDA put out, their interim final regulations right now, are very unworkable, and everyone's like, what the heck? Why did you write such terrible regs? In other words, it criminalizes at 0.42, saying that the feds can come in and treat it like cannabis at ridiculously low levels. And Agriculture Secretary Perdue testified in Congress very recently with apologies. Yeah, we let too much influence from the Justice Department in. Like, it's over. My message to our hardworking law enforcement is, we've got a meth and opioid problem, and really, like, please, pharmaceutical abuse, take care of that stuff. Cannabis is done. It's over. It's a positive thing. Leave it alone. Don't worry about it anymore. And that's, it's hard to get bureaucratic people to open their eyes and change their budgets and all that kind of stuff. But there was extra legal Justice Department influence on the first USDA regulations, and that needs to change, as well as the federal definition of hemp.
And then how do all of the federal regulations, the changing of them, how do they relate to the fact that the United States is signatory to the Single Convention Treaty on Narcotics that list cannabis as a Class 1 narcotic? I mean, does that not have to be changed as well as all of the federal laws? Don't we have to address that treaty?
Indeed, it does. I put a lot of my activism time and effort into that, into the international situation. And I have testified before the United Nations on exactly this topic. And there's a lot of people working very, very hard, especially Europeans, because the drug policy of the UN comes out of the Vienna office. And so, that will be taken care of, like all of the loose ends in this. Because we're winning, meaning the humanity's relationship with cannabis is returning to normal. Michael Pollan says we've co-evolved. And I live, you know, I really appreciate the people fighting door-to-door and fighting the final battles and slogging it out. But I'm living the next stage of, like, how do we launch it, all parts of the plant regeneratively? And this is not, like, a radical view. The state of Oregon, it is law passed by its legislature, signed by its governor in the state of Oregon, that it is legal for Oregon cannabis farmers, I'm talking ganja, psychoactive cannabis farmers, to export their cannabis, not just interstate, but internationally. And as long as it's okay in the place that's receiving it. And what Oregon is doing is it has a very powerful cannabis lobby. They were struggling with gluts and low prices following legalization. And this was to support their industry, saying the second federal law changes, Oregon farmers are dialed in to get their high quality terroir Emerald Triangle product, outdoor grown often, out to people that desire it in Missouri and New Jersey. So they're all, and to places already like Portugal and Uruguay, Oregon farmers, where it's legal, they can already send their cannabis. So this sort of minutia debate over these point whatever levels that are stagnating, that the USDA is dragging its feet on all this kind of stuff, these are short-lived things. The right side of history is cannabis wins. It's a multi-billion dollar industry.
There you go. I guess that's an answer to my question. But now, I'd like to hear about your adventures and misadventures of being a cannabis farmer. Because I'm sure a lot of people think, maybe I could be a cannabis farmer. It sounds like fun. Is it?
Skipping through a hemp field, and bees love hemp flowers, especially male flowers, is the most fun you can have outside the bedroom. I love being in a hemp field. I love watching the plants grow. It's an amazing phenomenon. It's really introduced me to the plant kingdom. Totemically, I've always been more of an animal guy, so this has been a real reintroduction to plant intelligence and how plants and our bodies use minerals and how they counterbalance one another. And it's a fascinating and fun thing for sure. If you are trying to save your family ranch and the idea of having a 3 or 5 year plan to positive revenue flow, as they say, is terrifying because you've got mortgage payments and bankers calling this week. You know, it's you know, that anything when it's really your job is going to be, can have its moments of nail biting. And I find on the misadventures, I mean, I'll try to tell a few funny stories on the misadventures side,
sure.
But I would say that the long term, the biggest sort of thing is people, the important thing is to have a long-term game plan, to be careful before just teaming up and partnering with people. Just because other people want to invest in hemp or grow hemp doesn't mean that you're going to share the same vision, values, and time frame. So these are the questions as to, you know, I just got an email the other day. A ranch up northern U.S. wants me to help them consult to get going. It's April 15th when they hear from me. Their deadline for applications in their state is April 30th. Should we do hemp this year? Can you come on board? It's like, you're just about in time for me to start helping you prep for next year. This is like anything, it takes preparation to do something professionally. And the difference of doing something for fun in your backyard and professionally is vast. You know, you can't just say I'm a dentist and go and get a dental chair and start pulling teeth or whatever. You've got to go to school for it. So, but if you're growing in your backyard for your family's food, that's easy and fun. Yes, without a doubt.
So there always is a difference between a vocation and an avocation. I always say that gardening is a wonderful avocation, but farming is a vocation, and there's an extreme difference in character for something that you love to do and something that you have to do. When you're gardening, you can wake up on Sunday morning and you know, wander out to the garden and pick some weeds, but when you're farming, you have to get up before sunrise and get your butt out there and work all day long. Different character, right?
You see where the rain dance and the sun dance came from, because you get out there and you plant, work hard, plant on the only days where everybody can be there planting. And then the next day, not the day you planted, but the day after, it rains, and you just give such thanks because that's what you need, a little water at soil contact for germination. And that's basically all hemp wants for a long time. And so, you know, it when it matters, when your mortgage payment is on it, it depends on it, it matters. Another difference between vocation and avocation, as you put it so poetically, is the lesson that many farmers, including myself, learned the hard way, which is if you're harvesting at scale for a seed flower crop, in other words, mixed greens when you harvest in your silo or in your grain bin or in your combine or wherever you do it, if you do it by hand, it gets hot very fast. Hemp gets unusually hot very fast. You have to get those seeds dried and cleaned right away or you lose it. It composts within hours, and it's very unusual. And so the clock is really on at harvest, and it's not hard to deal with as long as you prep for it. But an amateur who has not spoken to professionals or spoken to experienced hemp farmers won't know that going in. So there's some of the misadventures. I'll tell you quickly another misadventure, something I write about in the book, and this is a fun one in retrospect. The seed drill, the seed planting drill that ostensibly makes planting day easier by doing a row of, you know, eight, let's say, rows of hemp planted at the depth you program. Yeah, right. When it works is a fun thing, but it goes wrong almost every time, or it delays you so much that it sets you thinking about camp followers and hand planting and all that business again. And one misadventure is in yet another of the dozen poorly designed seed drills I've worked with across the world, the hemp was not flowing in by gravity, the seed, into the shoots in this seed drill. And so I and one of the other farmers, as the tractor is moving across the field, had to stand with brooms on the back of the seed drill, keeping our balance while arced forward unergonomically to sweep the seed down into the shoots so that they would be planted. So there's a misadventure for you.
And it always seems to be like that. It reminds me of a hay baler. You know, if you have this big, huge chunk of hay that you want baled, and you have to have this intricate machine to handle it, and they never do. Folks, this has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Doug Fine. He's the author of The American Hemp Farmer, Adventures and Misadventures in the Cannabis Trade. Doug, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael. I felt like we were able to get deep into everything. Thanks.
There you go. And thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.